existing via LEDs, the law enforcement data system, which is, and I was checking the statute, very restrictive about who can have access to the system. So we're talking about mainly an extension of criminal records that are presently kept. If you're convicted in the state of Oregon, the record's there unless it gets expunged. And all we're asking is that the records be kept updated is basically what you're saying. And my question is, why don't we require anybody who commits a felony in the state of Oregon for the rest of their lives to keep us updated as to their address? I'm just throwing it out. Why do we focus on these crimes? We do have other forms of sanctions, if you want to use that phraseology, which follow people to their grave unless they get the court to intervene. One of them is a new sanction we added last session, and that said ex-cons cannot possess firearms. It used to be it was only handguns that they couldn't possess, as I recall, and we extended it to firearms. So why are we nervous about just saying, well, we want to keep people's criminal records up to date if they've committed a felony, and as part of that, they should maintain an updated record, because no one else has access to this anyway. I'll throw that out to all of you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, we really didn't look at all felons simply because our charge was to look at registration of sex offenders and time limit. That's all I can tell you.
Council has some comments for us, I think, can help out on some of these questions. Learned counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in anticipation of this discussion, the House Research Department and I spent some time this morning looking at these very questions because I anticipated they would be here. First of all, it does appear that numerous states have enacted registries for sex offenders. California has a lifetime one. Washington starts out with a graduated system and has a starts out with lifetime registration. Interestingly enough, when they have been challenged in the courts, they have found to not be cruel and unusual punishment because they don't, quote, shock the conscience of the community. And one court went so far as to call it merely registering and did not see a problem subsequent to that. However, the one issue that I would like the committee to consider is that it seems like, and this was our cursory first review, that all states, and this includes Washington's, does have the ability in their statute to allow a person to petition the court to be relieved of the duty of the duty to register. For those of you that recall the discussions that we had last session in gun registration and the fact that the persons with felony convictions at some point have the ability to go back to the court and ask the court to be relieved of quote-unquote that disability and not and be removed from the registry, Washington has a similar procedure in their statutes, as does California. So I think the concern is, yes, it's constitutional. However, I think that the committee would be well advised to look at an option of allowing a person to petition the court if they feel like registration is no longer necessary, and I do have the Washington language here. The other analogy that we looked at was the challenges that were made to Oregon's habitual offender statutes, which were comparable, which were if you had X number of felony convictions, you were kind of branded, and those were also upheld by Oregon courts. Even though it made many bells ring in my head, it does appear as if it can be done, but I think that it would need to have some sort of relief petition provision in it so that if a person was, you can imagine a scenario of a 19-year-old who commits an offense, it's on the non-expungible list, it's on the reportable list, X number of years go by and there are no further offenses, that person might at least have the option of petitioning the court. And I apologize that we're not so well organized. This wasn't in memo form and on your desks this morning, but we do. By five will be fine. We'll take care of it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bauman.
What is, in these cases, what is the onus of registration? Sort of question A, and which it really seems a moderate, then we do have to decide this, and I'm not resolved in my mind whether this is some sort of mandatory participation in a corrections sort of sociological demographic pool, or whether it's an additional punishment. Well, we have to decide what it is. It's clearly one or the other, and And then my other question is, I think the onus is going to be defined by the scope of access to the registration record. And there are some real concerns with the scope of access. And there are concerns where I'm not sure that you can ever go far enough in making it available in terms of the, you know, parents of the young victim who discover too late that, you know, the neighbor has been registered all this time, but they weren't eligible for that information, although it would have changed their pattern. And then on the other hand, there is, you know, the former sex offender who is not a danger at all to the community, but who is stigmatized and ostracized and not able to get on with a real life because there is such liberal access to the registration that that he might as well be wearing a label on his house, or, you know, tattoo, or the yellow passport. So,
Mr. Chairman,
those are my issues.
Representative Mannix, thank you, Representative Allen.
The tactical problem here, or the strategic problem, is the use of the word register, and it creates the impression that we're talking about some poster that can be put up at the courthouse or circulated among concerned parents looking for babysitters. Am I wrong in reading? This is just saying that the criminal records, which already exist and will exist for the rest of that person's life unless they're expunged, will simply have an evident requirement that the person has to update those records by contacting whatever agency we decide to update their address when they move. And if they come in from out of state, they'd have to sign up to our record system. But our record system could well already have that information about someone who came in from the other state anyway, if we had a truly national criminal records identification system, which we do sometimes with the FBI, sometimes we don't. All you have to do is say yes, yes, yes.
I was going to say yes to all three questions.
Do you see what I'm getting at? Mm-hmm. Why do we keep calling this registration? We already have them in the records. We're simply updating their records, aren't we?
That's correct. If you want to use a different term for registration, but it's...
Well, we
phone home. Keep in touch.
All right. Chair Clark, the word registration was important to us because the statement was making the sex offender, though. Representative Mannix, we wanted the sex offender to know that the record was being kept or maintained, and we felt that's why the word registration had a little bit more impact than we're just upgrading, you know. And also it placed a burden on him or her to do something, whereas I don't believe under the process that you've just is the obligation of a man or woman coming out of OSP, OSCI, women's prison, who's committed a non-sex offense, that they have to go and make sure that their criminal records are kept up to date. This definitely says there's got to be some action on the part of the offender when he or she leaves that institution to keep the law enforcement officials current as to where he or she is.
I inquire on that?
It seems that I remember from some of Mary's testimony at another hearing that what little we do know about the treatment, we know that these folks, after their release, so to speak, still have to know they're being watched, and they have to know they're being watched very closely, and that does seem to bear some positive correlation to a lack of activity. Representative Mannix.
As a follow-up on that, then, shouldn't we require here that they be given notice at the time of their release of the registration requirement?
May I speak to that?
Sure.
Chair Clark, Representative Mannix, they are. That becomes a condition of their parole supervision. Even today, even though there's some question about that, we say to an offender, he committed his crime 10 years ago and he's getting out under supervision today, you're going to register as a sex offender, that's a condition of your parole. Everyone inside knows that that's going to happen. That's not a secret. There's one other thing about this requirement.
By the way, that may be in the rules and in practice, but it's not in the law. It doesn't say that the person shall be notified that this registry is being kept or anything like that. I mean, we all know it, but we don't say it.
It isn't stated in that fashion.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, the other thing I wanted to point out is that we are requiring additional information for this offender versus the other offender. if you commit an armed robbery, no one is going to talk with you about the style of behavior that goes into your armed robberies. If you're a sex offender, we want to know that what you do is cruise parks, or that you look at notices on bulletin boards in grocery stores, and that's the way you find your victims, because that helps us then identify who you are. I think that's a significant difference in this.
Is there another point here, if I can follow up?
Yeah, and then I want to get to Representative Bell, who's been patiently waiting.
We're also not talking about a person who just happens to la-di-da arrive in Oregon. When we talk about a person convicted in another state, a person convicted in another jurisdiction, if that person is paroled to this state under the parole statute. So I think that all this discussion about travel, freedom of travel, we're really talking about someone who's been paroled from another state here, and that's a very limited class of people we're talking about.
That's correct. Chair Clark and Representative Mannix, I think it is limited. We're not limiting anyone's right to travel here. We are saying that if you come here under parole supervision from another state where you convicted this crime, you will register. When we send people to California where there is a registry and has been since the 40s, they are required to register as a sex offender.
Representative Bell.
I've been mulling over the conversation in regarding to ongoing punishment, and it sort of set me off a surprise, because as I listened to what they have been telling us in these hearings, is the element of control in their lives is an element of treatment, an element of guidance and help. And I see this more in terms and light of ongoing treatment or ongoing help. We know so little, as they've mentioned, about this, that perhaps the closest we could relate it to would be the disease of alcohol, which a very important element of treatment is for the person to say, I am an alcoholic, and be able to tell people, I am an alcoholic. Now, we can do that voluntarily because alcoholism is a very overt kind of problem. Sex offense is very covert and very, very serious, and it never is done lightly. I mean, there's always damage done. So I see that maybe it's mandatory treatment in this case, that we require them to establish for themselves they are sex offenders, and they need to remember that all of their life and face the responsibilities that come along with that to change.
Do you have a, Reverend Bell, did you have a specific question for the witnesses?
I guess I was trying to dismiss this big worry about this being ongoing punishment.
Okay, we'll have a chance to adopt or not do so. Counsel.
I just have a question for Vern. The statute that was passed last session talks about a description of the offense. In rereading that this session, that seems more limited to that which you have described or that which you're utilizing. Do you think that that's an accurate statement, or if the registry, as it's written now, were to continue, that ought to be modified somehow?
Chair Clark, Holly, I'm not sure I understand your question, but I do have some concern about the way this is written right now, that it is very important for us to make sure that whoever implements this statute understands that what we want is a brief description, and it need be only very brief, of the offender behavior. Is that the issue you're speaking to? And your concern is that perhaps we haven't allowed for that.
Well, I'm not sure that the statute is as specific or as descriptive as what you perhaps would like or perhaps are doing. A description of the offense.
How about description, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
How about a description of the methodology of the offense?
Or something. It just seems to me that this is relatively narrow. A description of the offense would be rape of a child, which doesn't begin, I don't think, to look at the kinds of information that you're hoping
That's
to
correct.
Capture. So if, in fact, you want to do this for either to get modus operandi kinds of stuff or other kinds of narrative descriptors, whether it's, then I don't think that the description of the offense is broad enough and will accomplish that which the stated goals of the task force are.
Representative Bauman. I thought I heard you ask.
Yeah, you did. It appears to me that the extent of the registration of someone from out of state would only be the duration of their parole or probation.
That's right.
In this bill. So someone from out of state moving into Oregon who was a convicted sex offender in the state of Maryland and had completed their term of parole or probation would not register in Oregon. And that, you're
That's
nodding
correct.
Your head. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Sanceri and Representative Baumer, were you finished? I'm sorry.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't mean to be hung up on this, and I'm really enthusiastic about the bill, and I think it's good. It's just that I hate to see us go to a lot of trouble and then have it dismissed or set aside later because we didn't address everything. And I'm concerned as to how we are able to literally add on to a sentence from another jurisdiction. If it did not include registration when they were in Idaho, how can we force registration here in the state of Oregon without running into some kind of constitutional problem?
It's being done, Mr. Chair Clark, Representative Sanceri.
It's being done in other states.
It's being done in other states. I don't know.
Representative,
there are a number of things we require in the state of Oregon. I don't know whether it's a state's rights argument or not, of people who want to come and live here that aren't required in other states. And we didn't have that specific discussion that if you come from Idaho, let's say it doesn't have a sex registration law at all, and you come into Oregon and want to stay in Oregon, in Ontario, you better be registered. We didn't...
Representative Edmondson, I think, had a comment about your comment about the question.
A thought occurs to me, following up on Representative Baumann and Representative Sanceri's remarks. Folks who are coming into Oregon who would be subject to registration are on probation or parole in another state, and we're not, it's true under this bill, we're not attempting to extend that that parole or probation or any otherwise affect the terms of it. Now, my question is, what if a parolee or a probationer from another state is in the state of Oregon and that other state wants them? There's been a violation, for example. Oregon, I presume, has extradition agreements of that sort, probably interstate agreements. Mr. Potsner, you can help us here, on how and to what extent we cooperate with another state to honor the full faith and credit of their laws in that other state.
Chair Clark, Representative Edmondson, there is an interstate compact agreement that covers that, and if they want them, they can have them.
Okay. So
we send them home.
Wouldn't this law of registration really assist the state of Oregon in fulfilling that that interstate agreement by knowing where they are, and it would essentially facilitate that cooperation?
I think you could see it in that way.
In that regard, then, it might. I think that it perhaps has a very valid function to allow the state of Oregon to fulfill its obligation and its art by interstate compact has with other states to assist and cooperate with the supervision and of the parolees and probationers.
Chair Clark, if I may, to comment on Representative Sanceri's question about the ability to add this additional condition. It is not unusual for people to go to parole to other states and have additional conditions added to their parole conditions before the other state will accept them. It is not unusual for us in Oregon to say, if you're going to come to Oregon for parole supervision, given your history, we think you need this additional condition in order for us to help manage you, the offender, in our community while you're here. And this is part of the relationship and the agreement that's worked out through the other state. It happens fairly frequently.
What about somebody who's not on parole but has actually finished the sentence?
Chair Clark, I don't know how to answer that. I don't know how you pick these people up. I mean, if someone commits the offense in Maryland and they've served their time and they've discharged their sentence and they come to Oregon?
Bill wouldn't apply, in other words.
Right. Would not apply.
Okay. Committee, I really appreciate your diligence in looking at these questions. I think it speaks highly of the committee. I've asked counsel to do a couple things. Get us copies of the cases that she's looked at on some of these constitutional questions and also to ask someone either from the AG's office, the ACLU, or some other such place to come talk to us about some of the constitutional questions that might be wrapped up in this. We have several other witnesses on this bill and some on the next as well. So are there any last burning questions of this panel?
I have a request.
Okay. Representative Mannix.
I'd like to request some information on the California law, which apparently has been in effect since the 1940s. If you could provide that information, it would be, I think, of great assistance to us.
Well, Representative Mannix, what information would you like to have?
Do you have any kind of an outline of how it operates in California or anything like that?
No, I've talked with them a number of times, but I have nothing in writing. I would try to obtain that.
Well, we can check out the statute itself. I thought you might have a brochure.
If I had spare time, I'd be more than happy to take a field trip.
All right. Thank you very much for coming. Very helpful presentation. Continuing on with House Bill 2407, a couple more witnesses. I'm going to ask Major Dean Renfro from the Oregon State Police to come up and answer a few questions about the lead system and access to the registration and all of that, as well as your other testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, I'm Major Dean Renfro, Director of the Criminal Investigation Division of the Oregon State Police. I'm here to offer testimony in support of House Bill 2407. Each year, hundreds of persons who have been convicted of sexual crimes are released from custody or supervision in Oregon. There is now about 31,000 persons on parole or probation, and we estimate about 20% of those convicted for person violent crimes are sex offenders. Currently, these persons provide their addresses to the parole officer or probation department during the five-year period following their release. State police feel that registration of these offenders is extremely important, and lifetime registration would increase the effectiveness of the requirement. The lead system reports that in 1989, crimes against person offenses increased compared to 1988. Forcible rapes increased by over 21% and other sex crimes by over 17%. Now, in relationship to how information is obtained or extracted from leads, I'd like to cover that right now. The computerized criminal history section is operated by the Oregon State Police. That is offender information from arrest cards and disposition of court trials and arrest charges are given to the Oregon State Police for entry into LEDS. Any person, any citizen can obtain those arrest records. There is an open records law in Oregon. And what you do is write to the Oregon State Police Criminal Identification Services section, specifying the name and the age of the person to whom you request the record. There is a 14-day period where the state police contact the person whom the record request is made on to see if there's any challenge to his or her record. If there is none, then the record is sent to anyone making that request. So it is available. We do get those requests in quite commonly from the public. Back to those that have been charged with sex offenses, the Department of State Police reflects similar statistics as what I mentioned earlier. Our arrests for violent sex crimes and crimes against children have increased. Currently, the LEAD system reports that in the first 6 months of 1990, crimes against persons continue to increase compared to 1989. We offer the following advantages in support of a sex offender registration program. It provides law enforcement agencies and other criminal justice systems with the ability to track movements of convicted sex offenders beyond parole and probation. It alerts the criminal justice system of a sex offender registrant intent to reside within their jurisdiction. It requires sex offenders from other states to register in Oregon when they are paroled to the state. It enhances the capability of identifying sex offenders that may be responsible for sexual crimes committed after their release from supervision. It may serve as a deterrent to committing sexual crimes. And the reason we say that in itself providing a deterrent is because of the penalties associated with failure to provide a change of address. It's a felony, and in the event that the person was convicted of a felony sex crime or it's a misdemeanor, Class A misdemeanor, if the person had previously been convicted of a misdemeanor sex crime. It further provides a mechanism for law enforcement to notify the victims of specific sexual crimes as to their location of the convicted sexual offenders. Often offenders are repeat offenders, many of them having a multitude of victims. And it would appear to be an advantage to law enforcement and to the victims of crimes if those responsible for their particular offense move to an area near the victims, that they be notified of such. It also gives law enforcement the authority to enforce the law against those offenders that do not comply with the registration requirements. It provides a means for establishing a centralized register of convicted sex offenders that could be used for criminal profiling. Now, this is something that would be beyond LEADS. As discussed earlier, the name and the record would be updated. I propose to take even greater advantage of this law would to be development of a separate, standalone, computerized system that would entail the needed information of identifying description of the not only of the suspect in the case, but generally what type of victim they choose, what type of MO is used, perhaps the vehicle involved. So that, for example, if you had this in a database somewhere, and in Klamath County, the sheriff's office calls to the central database and says, we have a crime that involves a male suspect between the ages of 30 and 40. This is the description of him. He used a knife, and the victim in this case is a particular race of female age 10. Well, we'd go to the database, we'd plug in those particular, that descriptive data, and come up with a list of candidates as a prospective suspect in the case. And of course, you could even do it for a geographical area, say, for example, 100 mile radius of the particular crime scene. So I could envision that to be a tremendous tool for law enforcement. The Department of State Police feels that this type of cooperative approach would increase the number of sexual offender arrests and therefore reduce sex offenses that are occurring in the future. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that concludes my testimony. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Major. Questions for Major Winfield?
Judge Parks. I'm just curious about, you said the open records law. Do you know what chapter that is?
Not right offhand.
Okay.
I can get it for you.
Would you? I'd appreciate that. Save me, because I can never find it. And the mechanics of it are, if I wrote, if I contact state police and said I want the arrest record of Judy Bauman, I could have that. Could get that?
If you made a request in writing,
okay,
and specifying that, yes, you could.
Would I have to have a date, or would I, or just any time she'd been arrested?
You would have to have a date of birth and a name.
And would I get the police report, or would I just get a one-liner that says they were arrested in Multnomah County on such and such?
You would get a printout of a criminal history, if there was one.
The rap sheet, in other words.
Yes.
Would you charge him by the page for my rap sheet?
there would be a $10 charge.
Thank you.
But if you ask all committee members, it would only be 24 cents.
All right. Thank you, Major. We appreciate your testimony. Okay, committee, you need to know, by the way, we lose four members at 4:30, so we're going to have to move along here. Linda Erickson, would you come up, please? Welcome. Would you please identify yourself for the record? And it looks like you are from Carleton.
Yes.
And give us your testimony about House Bill 2407, please.
Okay, I'm Linda Erickson. I'm in support of the bill. I'm in support of any of the bills that empower the victims. This is my personal experience in our state concerning these issues. And I have written it down because I'm nervous and it's hard to talk. In 1984, when my daughter was 4 years old, she told me that her father was causing the reoccurring bruise on her tailbone when they played the, quote, tickle game. I immediately took my children and left our home. My daughter was evaluated by specialists in Eugene who confirmed that my daughter had been sexually molested by her father. My daughter disclosed to me the therapist in Eugene and the Lane County Police. She was also videotaped by the therapist as she disclosed. Coos County CSD, which is where the molestation occurred, evaluated my daughter as not having been sexually abused. At the hearing, which was also in Coos County, approximately 6 months after my daughter disclosed, the judge ruled that my daughter's father be awarded supervised visitation. This visitation was to be supervised by her father's mother, her grandmother, who testified at the hearing that she did not believe my daughter had been molested. My daughter was returned from one of these supervised visitations with deep scratches down the backs of her legs, caused, my daughter told me, when her father pulled her tights off of her when he was drunk. I ran out of money, had to file bankruptcy, and my attorney consequently told me to drop the case or my daughter's father would take me to court, reversing the charges and saying I had molested my daughter. I asked my attorney what would happen if I refused to let my daughter's father take her. I was told I would be thrown in jail for contempt of court and would probably lose custody entirely. During the therapy I provided for my daughter and am still paying for, I recalled that I had been molested between the ages of 8 and 12 by an older brother who is now a Douglas County sheriff. I entered treatment for chemical dependency in 1986 and am now employed by Yamhill County as a chemical dependency counselor. I have been chemically free for 5 years and have been a therapist for 4 years. In 1988, my present husband and I decided to move from the Coos Bay area to this area. We had stabilized in our recovery from chemical dependency and regained our financial status to a point we had worked towards.